Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Even fruits and nuts a little bit.
There's a big cut projected in cash receipts for major crops, but USDA chief economist Dr. Seth Meyer.
So, you know, there are some differences here. So for specialty crops, we actually see a little bit of an increase in the forecast for cash receipts into 24. So even within the crops, I think we've got to distinguish between corn, soybeans, kind of, and wheat, kind of the Midwestern row crops not faring well. Cotton faring very poorly in terms of cash receipts. And then other things like some of the specialty crops, either not seeing as big a declines or even some improvements. So from the specialty crop side, faring better than some of the other row crop and cotton production.
This is Agriculture Today.
If you look at the environmental aspects of ethanol, E15 is actually even a shade better on environmental metrics than E10, not to mention lowering greenhouse gas emissions.
Scott Richman is the chief economist with the Renewable Fuels Association on year-round E15.
So it really makes sense to go ahead and allow E15 year-round. We're calling for it. The American Petroleum Institute is calling for it. And it just makes too much sense not to happen pretty quickly. We're actually, the federal government, through the Inflation Reduction Act, has been providing incentives for ethanol infrastructure for stations that can offer E15, and we're seeing a pretty substantial expansion in that number of stations. So that's what's helping to expand ethanol consumption domestically at the same time that we're having this year by far a record level of exports. So really, we need both of those sources of demand. We need continued strong consumption domestically, and then we need to continue growing the export market.
As we near the end of the year and start looking to 2025, are there headwinds and tailwinds for the industry?
Yeah, there are both. And I would say more than headwinds, they're really just uncertainties going forward. Two of those, number one is tariffs. What sort of tariffs are we going to have under the new administration? And if those get put into place, how might other countries treat imports from the United States? I was just talking about this being a record year for U.S. ethanol exports. Canada's been taking about 35% of our ethanol exports. Mexico's been taking another 5%. Those are very important markets to us. So knowing that the tariffs get put into place strategically is very important for the ethanol industry, as it is for all of agriculture. That's number one. Number two is that the Inflation Reduction Act was passed a couple of years ago. And at the beginning of 2025, a tax credit program called the Clean Fuel Production Credit is slated to take effect. That would provide incentives for deep decarbonization of ethanol. Ethanol already reduces carbon intensity of fuels by about 50% relative to gasoline. This would help incentivize the industry for further reductions of carbon intensity of the greenhouse gas emissions from ethanol. And the industry has been interested in making investments based on that. This would help provide a return on those investments. So we really just don't know how that program is going to be implemented going forward with the change of administrations. But at the same time, we're hopeful. We've had two really good years in a row. Corn prices, even though they're difficult right now for corn growers, they're really helping to keep ethanol competitive in the domestic and international fuel markets. We don't see that changing for most of 2025. And as we build markets here for E15 and E85 blends above the traditional E10, as we keep expanding export markets, we're hopeful for another good year next year. We just have to keep out in front of people, in front of the public, in front of policymakers, letting them know what's important to our industry and what we need to help keep it growing.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Honestly, I think as we look at AI and GPT and quantum, you know, the need for sales reps in that is going to be dramatically different.
Matt Kastens is president and CEO of Landus, speaking at the Chicago Federal Reserve's Midwest Ag Conference.
The farmer piece is really simple. They got to drive costs out of it or make more money. I mean, and really the answer is they need to do both every year, right? How do we use technology to make them more efficient? And particularly in the farming, a little bit different than your question, David, you know, it's getting really hard to find somebody to work in rural. You know, if you've got a rural community, you've got the county, the major towns, you know, cities that are employing these folks. Those are the best jobs. You know, they show up for coffee at about 8, they back at coffee at 10, lunch at noon. I mean, ours is, we'll tell you when the train shows up, it could be any moment, and you're up there loading it for 24 hours, right? They go, hey, you know, that's not the deal. And then the farmer piece, you've got these peaks and valleys of spring and fall, hard work, physical work, and we have to bring more and more technology. We talked about this also at lunch. You know, the agriculture has been slow to adopt technology. You know, you look at what military and space can do. And some of those things, most of those things are very transferable, which you'll see most of them in our innovation connector, to ag. But we seem to resist it because somebody's got to get a pocketbook out. And in the ag channel, you go from a manufacturer to a distributor to a retailer to a farmer. Like in 2024, if that makes any sense, let me know. And everybody's got their hand out, taking money out of that supply chain to where innovation is stalled. And also profit continues to be a struggle all the way to pricing to the farmer. So to your question, we spend a ton of time on how we drive cost out and how we improve yield. We're also spending a lot of time right now on how we find new markets for their grains. You look at something like what was announced here last month with Brazil and putting a port with China in Peru. And now that is a clean path for corn and soybeans to China, which our exports to China clearly show that. And absent a major drought, because remember, Brazil's got two bites at the apple of grain production. Absent a major drought, that's way, way gone for us. And we see it. We see it in today's prices. We see it in the future or lack of future optimism on commodity pricing. So we have to think about things different. We have an office now in Guadalajara. We've got two employees living in Mexico, reporting to an international leader that we just hired. And this is all, these all just happened in the last 3 months since you've been out to see us. So the change is here, and the change has got to be, you know, tariffs, whatever. We can't, I don't think there's anybody in this room that can influence. If you can, I'd like to visit with you afterwards. But assuming there's nobody that can influence that, how do we deal with it? How do we solve the equation? And ag has truly rested on our laurels for many, many years. We've got to be leaders in this room and leave here and go, how are we going to deal with these things? How do we create a different day for ag, for the farmers, for these rural communities? And unfortunately, there's not an easy answer to any of that, David. I didn't save any surprise for you on that one. But I do think it's meetings like this where we get honest with the challenges and the changes that are upon us and what we can do to drive cost out and continue to improve overall production and dealing with pricing as best we can in that middle ground there.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
1 point of GDP is about $300 billion.
Representative David Schweikert from Arizona sounds the alarm on the nation's debt.
So you get about 17-18% of GDP in tax receipts. So let's see if 300 billion, 17%, $48 billion. So if I 1% of GDP growth only gets me $48 billion, you do realize that means you'd in a single year have to have like 40, 41, 42% GDP growth to cover the debt deficit of this year. It's absurd. I beg of people, learn your math.
So can we cut our way out?
I was talking to some constituents this week. Actually, I was listening to them because I had almost no voice. And one of them was talking about some things they saw in the press of what would happen if we got rid of this department or this department. And I did the math for them. the entire civilian, so non-uniform workforce in America, last year's salary cost was about $213 billion. Think about that. If we're borrowing $2 trillion, if you fired every non-uniform person in the federal government, everyone, they're all gone, you just covered 10% of the shortfall this year. There's a lack of understanding of the scale. So we're going to actually do a little bit of that. But first, I thought there was a trance tonight. I'd come to the floor and say we just crossed $36 trillion. We're close. We're very, 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 very close. It looks like the Treasury may have reached into a little bit of their cash supply. Remember, Treasury keeps sometimes from $400 to $800 billion of cash. $500 is more normal. But we'll hit this before the week's over. So think of that. We clicked off another $1 trillion from 35 to 36 trillion, and we did it in about 113 days. And the projection is we'll go from this 36 trillion to 37 trillion in about 100 days. Think of that. We're functionally borrowing about $70,000+ a second. And yet you walk through this math. So let's actually try to get a sense of what's going on. This chart is a little hard to read, but I want to make a point. I've done entire floor presentations here of showing here's all the tax hikes that the Democrats have proposed that have been scored. And then you do the economic adjustments, and you functionally get about 1.5% of GDP. The things we want to cut, if you go to non-defense discretionary and cut almost a third of non-defense discretionary, that's about 1% of GDP. So you got our 1%, they're 2.5%. You add that together, or excuse me, 1.5%, our 1%, you got 2.5%. We borrow just a little under 7% of the economy this year. Anyone see a math problem? When the left's tax hike solutions and our cut solutions get you 2.5% and we're borrowing close to 6%. But the reason I have this chart here, functionally in 9 budget years, we go from a little under 6% of the entire economy being borrowed money by the federal government to 9.2%. That basically means in about 9 budget years, we're borrowing close to $4 trillion a year. And that's on the baseline right now. That's with all of our taxes going up after next year. That's with none of the new programs, none of the new spending. That's just where we're at today. That's current law. Anyone see a math problem?
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
RFA represents America's ethanol industry. We represent them in D.C. We keep track of what's going on in the markets, and we're their voice to the public and to policymakers.
Scott Richman is Chief Economist, Renewable Fuels Association.
Well, actually, we're going to be at or near record production this year. We've had several weeks where, according to the Department of Energy, we've hit record levels. And we've been really firing on all cylinders all year. And as you mentioned, production and the demand side are related. We've had good news on the demand side, and that's let us keep going on the production side.
What about year-round E15?
Well, we're actually really hopeful that in the lame duck session of Congress, they'll go ahead and pass a bill that's been out there that's supported by the ethanol industry. It's actually supported by the American Petroleum Institute, to go ahead and allow nationwide year-round E15. The last few years, we've had emergency waivers from the EPA allowing E15 during the summer. This legislation would allow it permanently, and there's really no reason not to have it.
Year-round E15 has been a challenge, but what about exports?
Yeah, it's actually been the real bright spot for this year. We're going to have by far a record level of exports. We're going to surpass the previous record by a couple of 100 million gallons. We're going to surpass 2023 levels by about 450 million gallons. So if you think about ethanol, one bushel of corn makes about 3 gallons of ethanol. You can do that math. It's been very helpful to the ethanol industry. It's been helpful to the corn market. And the major destinations are, the top destinations are Canada, the United Kingdom, the EU, in India. And what those countries have in common is they have policies that are very supportive of ethanol consumption there. For example, in Canada, you've had clean fuel regulations take effect, and you've had some provinces that have changed their regulations on renewable fuels in ways that have been helpful. The United Kingdom, they went to a 10% ethanol or E10 standard a couple of years ago, and that's really lifted consumption and the level of shipments into the UK. And so we think this is something that can continue going forward in future years. When you look at the competitiveness of U.S. ethanol and you look at the greenhouse gas savings that it offers, that's something that is in demand worldwide.
But with challenges at home, like year-round E15, is there an opportunity to grow more export markets?
Those countries that I was talking about, those are the primary destinations, and they've actually grown over the last couple of years. So we've seen significant growth there. But there are also countries where they are looking at ethanol as a solution. One of my colleagues, Tad Heppner, our VP of Strategy and Innovation, was just in Indonesia and Vietnam. Those countries are looking at going to E5 blends, potentially taking that to an E10, 10% ethanol blend. And we were talking about India already being one of the major destinations for ethanol. India is trying to go over the next couple of years to a 20% ethanol blend. So there are plenty of opportunities overseas for U.S. ethanol producers. We just have to keep on growing those markets over time.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Data is obviously more and more important. I would say ag is still way behind on the curve on data.
How important is data in ag? Matt Karstens is president and CEO of Landus.
You know, we're starting a system that you got to see called Synthesis that is a partner out of Kansas City that works with Space Force and several other companies from the government side. Took that same technology and created this. Synthesis is like a vortex of data. And a farmer can use past and current conditions to forecast the future. And its accuracy is off the chart. I mean, we're using satellite imagery that we actually got hooked up with NASA through Secretary Vilsack. And using satellite imagery, weather patterns, we actually now have a climatologist on our staff. Eric Snodgrass works for us, and taking the forecasts of everything, every bit of data that we can shove into this thing to run algorithms, AI, GPT or LLM type of analysis that puts the power back in the farmer's hands.
Speaking at the Chicago Federal Reserve's Midwest Ag Conference, he talks about AI.
Today, a farmer can log in. We're with Tesseract down in Kansas City working on our own GPT system, you know, and it just builds every day, every bit of data just keeps building itself. It's not public yet because it's going through that building stage. But, you know, from where that thing is started to where it's at, you know, and I say where it, I don't even know what it is, right? It's just this thing that is in the cloud building, and the things that it can answer for you is scary, and not only accurate but smart. Like it takes all these variables and go, here's what life will be like this year. Here's what the answer to that equation is for the farmer. We had one of our farmers. This is a funny story. Lyme doesn't spread very well, and they pile it. And he was trying to figure out what big of space he needed. Plugged it into this GPT and it said, yeah, you need this by this. It's going to be this high. And it's going to, like, I went to Iowa State, so I'm not that smart. Obviously, we're not talking about Harvard stuff here. Like, no chance I could do that, right? No chance he could put the data in this many acres, this many, what's the space he needs based on this, answers it in seconds. Like, it, there it is. That's where we're going. And you all go, well, yeah, that's just our life. But you have to remember, these folks are in the middle of nowhere. Like, I mean, their night out is to a greasy spoon. And I mean, you're eating the grease from the bat that made it, right? And that's the world they live in. We did this test. We had our farmers in last August. No, February. February of this year. I said, you know, who in here is our board? So it's our board. So these are some of the best farmers across the Midwest. And I said, you know, who in here knows what ChatGPT is? There's 12 of them in the room. How many do you think raised their hand? One. And I'm not sure, he just didn't hear about it and no idea. So I showed him. I actually developed Steph's job description right in front of him. I said, you know, I just got this email this morning. HR needs a darn job description. I said, Ag, chief of staff. And it chuckers it out in 30 seconds, all the way through. I mean, you all have used it, right? But the farmers are watching this going, what world are we living in? And now we're building one for them around livestock, around grain storage, around grain production, around efficiencies, around storing wine. I mean, it's just crazy what we can do here. But we sometimes are, not sometimes, maybe all the time, are our worst enemy. You know, because somebody's got to lead the farmer, right? And somebody's got to sacrifice some profit to get to this and demonstrate and show them where we can go. And that's, in my opinion, been the big obstacle.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
When I first sat down, a general came into my office and he said, sir, it's nice to meet you. Would you please sign this? I said, what is it? It's a contract for a new Air Force One.
Prior to the election, President-elect Donald Trump speaking at the Economic Club of Chicago.
And I said, how much is it? $5.7 billion. It's a hell of an expensive plan, but there's reasons for that. And he said, nope, I'm not signing it. I said, who negotiated? Barack Hussein Obama. I said, I'm not signing it. Why? Because there's a lot of fat. And he said, I'm not signing it. It's got to have a three on it. Anyway, long story short, some of you have heard this. I got it down to, because first week they cut off $400 million. He said, I'll cut. I met with the head of Boeing. Wait, Dennis. I said, Dennis, you got to have a three. 5.7 is too much. 5.7 billion. He said, the most I'll take off is $400 million. I said, well, that's not bad for one conversation. So he got it down. I said, nope, I'm not accepting. Then he took off two more. Then he took off. Anyway, 2 months went by, 3 months went by. I thought we blew the deal, and I was okay with me. I didn't care. But we should have a new Air Force One. When we see these planes from Saudi Arabia, from different countries, brand new, and ours is like 32 years old, and it's a very different plane. It's a much smaller plane, you know, the whole thing. The United States should have the best plane, I will tell you. Not for me, but we should have it.
Let me just finish.
Would you? So he said, he calls up after like 2-3 months. I didn't call him, which is the best way to buy something. Don't call back. And he goes... In fact, when he called me, I said, I wonder what the hell he wants. That's a good way to negotiate, let me tell you. So he calls back, said, sir, $3,999,999,999.99. 1 penny above, below $4 billion. So I said, you got yourself a deal. Then I said to him, let me ask you a question. So you had a deal at $5.7 billion, and in a period of 2 months, I got $1.7 billion off. That means you're going to make $1.7 billion profit on an airplane. Did nobody ever negotiate with you? Well, not really, sir. This is the price. And they said, we'll take it. And I said, you know, and then I learned, that was my first experience, you know, from that. But then I learned everything is like that. There is so much waste. So I'm getting, think of this, the exact same plane for $1.7 billion less. Exact, except I have a better paint job. Okay, much better paint job. A different color, red, white, and blue is beautiful. And if you look at every contract, that's one contract, and relatively small compared to most. Think of it. You save $1.7 billion because you negotiate. Every deal is like that. We're building ships that are costing 2-3 times more.
Can you give me an example of
something? There's tremendous waste, fraud, and abuse in our country. And if you could cut it, you would have a surplus without even going into growth. But growth, we will grow. We're going to bring companies and jobs in at levels that you've never seen.
And suggest it could start with the European Union.
Millions and millions, of course. And then I said farm products. You know, they don't want our farm. They don't want anything from us. We have deficits that are crazy. And we're not going to have them anymore. We're going to put tariffs on them. And they're going to do, and you know what they can do? The Mercedes-Benz will start building in the United States. And they have a little bit, but you know what they really are? Assembly, like in South Carolina. But they build everything in Germany, and then they assemble it here. They get away with murder because they say, oh, yes, we're building cars. They don't build cars. They take them out of a box and they assemble them. We could have our child do it.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Started off very early with Hurricane Beryl, a Category 1 system that hit the middle Texas coast, but created quite a bit of destruction.
USDA's Brad Rippey on five major hurricanes.
About a month later, we had Hurricane Debby moving into Florida's Big Bend as a Category 1 hurricane. Unfortunately, that portended the fact that we would have another hurricane hitting almost the exact same area just about a month and a half later. That was Hurricane Helene, the deadliest hurricane of the 2024 season. Helene, a Category 4 system when it moved inland in Florida's Big Bend, causing absolute devastation due to heavy rain and flooding in the southern Appalachians. Before Helene hit, we actually saw Francine, a Category 2 hurricane, hitting earlier in September. That system moved ashore across southeastern Louisiana. And then finally, Milton reached the Florida coast just south of Tampa Bay as a Category 3 storm in early October.